coming up on this special edition of The Green from Delaware Public Media. We continue our series of 2024 candidate conversations with interviews from the race for Delaware Lieutenant Governor. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our look at the Lieutenant Governor campaign focuses on two candidates, Democrats Kyle Evans-Gay and Debbie Harrington. Plus, our Races to Watch series heads to Kent County for the Democratic primary in the 29th House District. That's all next on this special edition of The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. As part of our 2024 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is offering a series of candidate conversations. We reached out to all candidates filed to run in the races for U.S. House and U.S. Senate, as well as governor, lieutenant governor, and insurance commissioner, and invited them to sit down with us. Candidates in each race are being asked about the same set of topics to allow you to get to know them and compare them. The interviews here on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. The race for lieutenant governor features four candidates seeking to replace Democrat Bethany Hall Long, who is running for governor. Today, we focus on two of the candidates, Democrats Kyle Evans-Gay and Debbie Harrington. We start with Gay. She is making her first run for statewide office. She was elected to represent the 5th State Senate District in North Wilmington in 2020, flipping a seat held by Republicans for 40 years prior. The lieutenant governor's role is often what a person makes of it. That makes it a little bit unique, as you noted. How do you feel specifically you would make that position consequential? It sounds like you do have some issues that you would kind of like to be in your lieutenant governor portfolio.
Absolutely. It is quite a privilege to be able to build a portfolio in that way. But let's first start with what's absolutely in the portfolio. I'll start with presiding over the Senate, making sure that one chamber in our branch of government is operational is no small feat. And I think that it is a very influential and important role to work both across the aisle with the House, and to make sure that the lieutenant governor can be a person who is bringing the legislature in on some of the most important goals and leadership opportunities that the administration sets out for us starting next year.
I do want to jump in there and ask, because one of the things I did want to ask you about is that presiding over the Senate, a lot of people maybe don't think of that as a key piece of the lieutenant governor's role. They think of it as more like a ceremonial type of role. But I guess what you're saying is you feel like, in a time when there's kind of maybe strong partisan tensions, that the lieutenant governor in that role can set or maintain the tone and agenda for the state Senate, at least.
Absolutely. And I would say even beyond, I would say in the legislature writ large. Okay. And I don't think I could have said it much better than you did. But really, the way I think about it is as a almost chief legislative liaison, as the eyes and ears of the administration within within Legislative Hall. Keep in mind that in addition to that presiding role, the lieutenant governor has that opportunity to leverage existing relationships. I really feel that in this day and age when I feel grateful that we have a Democratic trifecta here in Delaware, I believe that is an opportunity but also a responsibility. And I do believe that we can do better at moving together, the House, the Senate, and the administration, on our shared goals for Delaware and setting out a mission, how we're going to reach that mission, and really showing Delawareans that we can work together in concert to achieve it. I don't think that happens without someone in that seat in the Senate who is willing to bring their relationships to bear, is willing to be a good negotiator, and is willing to really put Delawareans first and above politics.
And I do want to circle back and let you talk a little bit more about what else you feel is in that portfolio as
a
lieutenant governor, or at least what you would like it to be in your portfolio.
Yes, thank you. So separately, the Board of Pardons is absolutely in that portfolio. one thing that people might not know about my background is that I've practiced criminal law. I've been in trial. I have made opening and closing arguments in front of judges. I've also served at the appellate in the appellate level in the criminal law system. And so I have seen what it means to go back and understand where justice has not been done in prior years. I've worked in that role with victims as well, understanding what they have gone through. And I would be the first lieutenant governor, the first chair of the Board of Pardons to bring that experience to the role. And I do believe that as Board of Pardons, there's an obligation to get things done, to make it move quickly, to ensure everyone is heard, and that includes families and families of victims. But also, there's an opportunity to use that position to state very clearly what we feel is important as far as continuing to reform our criminal justice system. But getting to kind of what I would create, those who know me, those who have watched me work in Dover, understand very well that I do my job on behalf of kids. Mm-hmm. And so that has resulted in a focus on childcare, on early education. And so I would really hope that my role, you know, could be chief kids officer or however you want to phrase it, but that I would be in a way empowered to do the work I believe will help both our economy and our educational outcomes and remove disparities for children and future generations. That would be a privilege to be allowed to do that work.
So since you mentioned kids and education, yes. Let me jump into that particular area, because obviously education, and specifically education funding, have been significant issues recently in this state. The lawsuit over education funding equity led to a report in the fall on education funding that recommended the state spend an additional $600 million to $1.1 billion per year. You and your fellow lawmakers did create a public education funding commission to look at the funding structure in the coming months. But I'm interested in what you think personally about where things stand with education funding, starting with, based on that report, should the state be spending more?
It's a great question and one that has plagued us for years. What is the volume of spending versus what students are receiving as far as opportunities to advance? And I think I'm going to be relying a lot on the commission and a lot on our partners in education to help shape that answer to that question going forward. What I will say is that teachers are underpaid when it comes to comparisons with our area states. So I know we're going to need to pay more simply to recruit and retain the workforce we need to do the job. When it comes to investing in types of learning where there haven't been those additional investments, I'm thinking about English language learners. I'm thinking about special education. I'm thinking about schools like the one my kids attend, Title I schools, who thankfully receive federal funding. But what else can we be doing for those populations or those schools that have a population in poverty, right? And so from my perspective, there are places that we need to invest. I'm interested in knowing whether we are investing in areas that we shouldn't invest in as well. So do I think overall education funding has to go up? Likely, but I am more interested in understanding the state of play as it is today.
Based on what you're saying, I'm curious if you feel like one of the primary areas to look at is the actual structure of funding. And that is specifically, is it time to move on from the unit system and look for a weighted funding system that other states use or some combination of those two?
It is. And I apologize if I wasn't as clear about that. But I'm glad you mentioned or something or some combination, because truly where you have seen some of the most significant and successful reform in other places is where states have moved away, or counties, right, depending on where funding is done in other places, where they have moved away from that traditional unit funding system, but preserved pieces of that system that allow for things like predictability or long-term planning for our local school district. There will always be winners and losers when you make a change like this. That's a political reality. It's our job as leaders of the state in the next administration to ensure that everyone is at a table to understand where they will be affected and how, and to make sure the state can be there to support in whatever way possible a status quo of funding so that we don't lose teachers and staff and other individuals who, like I said, are so critical to making sure education happens every day.
Right. To that point, you talk about bringing people to the table, and you also mentioned earlier that this has been a problem that's bedeviled the state for quite some time. We've seen a lot of different tables that people have been brought to, from Vision 2015, WEAC, WEAC, Reading Consortium. Is there an urgency now to do something?
Absolutely, there is an urgency. And I think the urgency that we are feeling now is creating a political will to do something great. And that is a great responsibility. What is on the table now, where there's a possibility, is that we have to find the funding. Mm-hmm. And we have to understand what we're going to do as a state and what our investment is.
I want to move on to another issue that is also becoming much more important throughout the state, that is affordable housing, a very complex issue, much like education. Where do you feel the state can be most effective in addressing it? Where should the state focus its efforts to have perhaps the most impact quickly?
I do think the state can be most effective in unifying parts of the county codes so that there's more predictability statewide. Mm-hmm. I think that areas to look at are density. I think that permitting needs to be looked at as well. Most importantly, when you're talking about bringing individuals here to invest, whether it's businesses or in housing, and we're talking about housing here, we want there to be an understanding of how they can do business here so that we can encourage them and incentivize them in some cases to create the types of housing that we need. We don't just need houses that millionaires can afford, mm-hmm. right? We need housing that people, everyday Delawareans, can afford. And so I'm interested in making sure that we are, that the state is demonstrating, whether it's through funding or opportunities for investment, that we believe in building the types of housing that is needed.
I want to move on to healthcare. Healthcare mm-hmm. costs and access also becoming pretty stubborn issues in the state. Delaware has one of the highest costs of care in the nation, and at the same time struggles to attract and retain providers and specialists. It plays out in a lot of areas. We know specifically within the state government, cost of coverage for state employees and retirees, but also areas like dealing with care for an aging population in the state. Lawmakers did work on state retiree benefits this year, also created a hospital cost review board. Building on those things, what would you advocate prioritizing in terms of addressing healthcare cost and access in the state?
Well, you heard that Delaware did move on to look at healthcare costs from a hospital standpoint. Mm-hmm. And we really can't just focus on hospitals. We need to look at other cost drivers within the healthcare system. And so I think in the coming years, you're going to have legislators and the administration alike taking a look at ways in which our healthcare system, the way it has been created in America, right? We do not have universal healthcare. Mm-hmm. What the effects are for consumers here, whether it's from, pharmacy costs, pharmacy benefit costs, or other pieces, insurance being a big piece of the puzzle, and thankful for our insurance commissioner's work there. And this question about how can we recruit doctors, nurses, PAs, right, APRNs, how can we train people to become, hospital assistants? All of that is wrapped up in every other economic issue and education issue that we're going to talk about today, because we currently cannot offer physicians or other medical professionals moving to Delaware a public school system that has a greater than 40% proficiency at the fourth grade level, right? And so we need to offer that. We currently have a housing crisis that makes it unaffordable for, say, a nurse who needs to work at BB in Lewis to be able to live within a half hour of work. And I'll go back to childcare because people need to hear it. Right, that same nurse may have to drive a half hour the other direction, west, in order to drop their child off for affordable and available childcare before driving back east to serve our most vulnerable seniors in a Lewis hospital system. And so this is a question that will rely on our willingness to leverage that political will we talked about earlier to do something big in the areas of education and housing.
You talked about the interconnected part of all of this. And part of that interconnection, obviously, is the budgetary piece of it. Everything we're talking about comes with some kind of cost. The outgoing governor, John Carney, is taking I think arguably a more cautious and pragmatic approach towards spending, emphasizing one-time spending, so-called budget smoothing, to set aside dollars to hedge against future economic downturns. What approach would you advocate for to balance spending that's necessary with fiscal responsibility?
I'm very grateful to our governor for the work that he has done to manage us through COVID in particular, but throughout his 8 years. And we in the legislature have taken steps to codify some of the structures around making sure that we have that long-term stability. What I think has been frustrating with one-time spending, not from my perspective as a legislature, but from my constituents' perspective, is that with certain types of one-time spending, they look great on paper, but they don't allow initiatives to grow and plan in a way that you might, as a business or a nonprofit, do. And so I think really looking forward, there are a couple strategies that I would advocate for. One is that Delaware needs to be at the national table advocating for federal funds that are available to be applied here in Delaware. I believe there should be a group, in whether it's in an office or reports to the governor, to ensure that we are doing a survey of what's available at the federal level and offering grant writing assistance internally and implementation assistance if needed to our many agencies who could benefit from federal money. So that's one thing on the table. That's not going to solve all of our problems, but it's a strategy that I believe has been under-leveraged in recent years. I also think that we need to focus our one-time spending on innovative pilots that are data-driven and that are designed with an intention to fund later. I'm really proud of a pilot program I worked on with the Housing Authority. We have been funding rental reporting. Many people don't know that a rent payment does not go onto a credit score. So what we have been doing is piloting with 400 families a program that gets their rent reported on their credit score with the hopes of enabling them to secure credit for either a home loan, a business loan, student loans, whatever is that next step for them. And that is something that is absolutely feasible and fundable at a larger level. I would like to fund more pilots like that that allow us to see where we should go and that aren't stopgap measures as far as funding.
In a time where there seems to be maybe more mistrust in government, what role do you feel the Lieutenant Governor's office and you personally could play in giving Delawareans greater transparency and accountability from their government?
If only, right? I acknowledge that there is this partisanship, I think, that is driving a mistrust in government, and it hurts my heart. I believe you build trust at the community level. I believe you build trust by being excellent at what you do and by being responsive. And I do believe that you build trust by demonstrating that you are meeting the needs that people are telling you they have. And I think that in one case in particular, or one issue in particular for Delawareans, is customer service. And I do believe that it is difficult for many Delawareans to access the agencies they need, the departments they need, when they're either going through a crisis or they don't know who to turn to, or they're doing something very normal, like receiving benefits from the state. I believe that focusing on customer service and responsiveness and making sure that we can solve everyday problems will be the start of building those blocks for overall increased trust and partnership, clearly partnership with community.
I do want to ask, because some of your GOP colleagues and some government transparency groups have floated this idea of an inspector general's office. Is that something you would support or at least consider going forward?
I would absolutely consider it going forward. I listened when our state auditor told us that she needs support as well. And that really spoke volumes to me. If we are not adequately funding the auditor's office to look into areas that we could be doing more work in, increased transparency, I'd like to fund her office. I'd like to empower her to do her work. And then if there are pieces outside of her mandate that she either can't touch or that we need to bolster, then the answer may very well be an independent inspector general. But I'm really interested in making sure our auditor's office is also well-placed to do the great work, quite frankly, that we've asked her to do.
That's Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor Kyle Evans Gay. Our full conversation with her is available at DelawarePublic.org. Up next, our candidate conversation with another Democrat in the Lieutenant Governor's race, Debbie Harrington. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to a special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. And I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our candidate conversations with more from the race for Lieutenant Governor, where we now turn to another Democrat running, Debbie Harrington. Harrington is making her first run for statewide office. She previously ran for the 9th District House seat in 2018 and 2020. In 2018, she lost in a 3-person Democratic primary. In 2020, she lost to incumbent Republican Kevin Hensley in the general election. A reminder, the interviews you hear here on The Green are edited for time. Full conversations are online at DelawarePublic.org. The Lieutenant Governor's role is often what a person makes of it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel you could make the Lieutenant Governor's office consequential? Are there issues that you feel like you would want to make your own or be in like your portfolio as Lieutenant Governor?
Yeah, so it kind of mirrors the challenges that I have seen in my personal life, in my family's life, and in my community, in terms of education. I came to Delaware 18 years ago, and it was about education. So, and I've remained in that. Now I'm on the Board of Trustees at Delaware State University. I'm on the Early College School Board of Directors. So I'm still involved in education, still trying to make a difference in education. So that's an area that I want to focus on. I think if we can get education right, we get a lot of other things right. We have less crime. We have less mental health issues. We have less unemployment. And it goes on. So I think we really do have to focus on education. So that's an area that I will absolutely focus on and insert myself in that. Another area that I will definitely do, I'm unlike all the other candidates, I'm a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
I am a veteran, and so I will be very much involved in how we take care of those 70,000-plus veterans we have in Delaware and their families. So those are, two areas that I'm very much focused on going into that office. And, the current Lieutenant Governor has She started the Behavior Health Consortium, and that has become a staple, I believe, in the community. And I think we still have some work to do, and I understand the part of that. I'm also on the Board of Examiners of Psychologists, and I know that we're short those professionals. And so I know that there's work to do. We saw after COVID a uptick in mental health challenges, and I think we have to expand our infrastructure to meet those needs. So those are three areas that I would say immediately I want to focus on as a lieutenant governor.
And before we delve into some of these issues, I do want to ask kind of one more lieutenant governor specific question, and that is that, one of those roles that the lieutenant governor plays is presiding over the state Senate.
Yeah.
And in a time of strong partisan tensions, do you feel like the lieutenant governor in that position presiding over state Senate can help play a role in setting or maintaining a positive tone?
Yes, I do. I really do. I think you can, the lieutenant governor as the chair of the Senate could establish that kind of tone. And I'll tell you, unlike all the others who are running for lieutenant governor, I served in the military for 25 years. And in 25 years, I never, ever had the opportunity to choose who I worked for. Never. And so sometimes I would say that I've worked for people who are polar opposite in values, beliefs, but always, always we were able to come to a consensus. And that is the kind of tone that I would bring into the Senate, where we work across the aisles, where when the people have decided who will represent their districts, then that's what they've decided. And we take that and we come in and we're able to work and come to consensus on things. And that's the kind of culture I would want to bring to the legislature.
So let's talk about some issues. And since you talked a lot about education, let's start there.
Yeah.
Specifically, I guess, education funding, which has been a significant issue recently.
Yeah.
The lawsuit over education funding equity led to a report that was released last fall that recommended the state spending an additional $600 million to $1.1 billion per year on education. Lawmakers this past session did create a public education funding commission to look at the funding structure and some of the recommendations in that report. But what I'm interested in, is what you think about education funding. Starting with, should the state be spending more, and if so, where?
Yeah, no, I think that, first of all, I think the short answer to the question is yes, I do believe. I think we have to decide as a state to invest. We have to get it right. And in order to get it right, we have to decide, we have to figure what does it cost to educate a student? What does it cost to educate a student? What does it cost to educate a student with disabilities? What does it cost to educate a student with complex disabilities?
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that amount is, let's make sure that every student has that amount invested in them. So sometimes it takes more. Right now we have 19 school districts,
mm-hmm.
19 different ways of funding. And, of course, some of those is a lot of inequities in
mm-hmm.
there. And so I think we have to look at our funding structure, form a task force, if that's what it takes, to figure out what does it take to ensure that every student has a quality education.
It is part of the process looking at the state funding formula, which is decades old.
Yes.
A lot of people have talked about the idea of getting rid of the unit system or building on the unit system to try and make sure that there's some version of weighted funding that we see in other states. Is that something you think is part of the process of getting it right?
Yes, I do think that that is part of the process. And then something I did leave out we have to invest in early education.
Mm-hmm.
We have to really decide to set aside funds to start early for every student, for every child, so that every child has access to that early learning. You know, you begin to learn to read.
Mm.
So some of those things that we are having difficulty with now, reading, doing math on grade level, those things we start early. But we also start socializing. They understand good behavior. We get our parents involved because a lot of things that our parents have to be involved as well. But let's begin early to teach our children, teach our parents how to be involved in their students' education.
One last question on the education piece. And I think when we talk to a lot of people about education issues in the state, what we often hear is, hey, we've seen a lot of talk about education.
I know, right?
Vision 2015, WEAC, Reading Consortium.
Right, yes.
How important is it for you, and is it something you consider a priority to find a way to find actionable things to do to improve education?
Yeah, and I was on an interview the other day, and somebody said exactly what you're saying. A lot of talk. No action. And I think it is absolutely time. It's very important that we stop just talking about it. Let's just stop talking. We've been talking about the funding issue forever.
Mm.
And so let's just stop talking about it and just take real action to ensure that we have the right funding structure, that we have the right education programs, that we support our teachers, that we get qualified teachers in the school system. And in order to do that, in order to keep them, perhaps, maybe even perhaps we can get them, but can we keep them? In order to keep them, let's pay them the right amount of salary. So, yes, I think it's very important that we do so.
Let's talk about affordable housing, because that's an issue that has become increasingly
yes.
important throughout the state. Very complex issue. Where do you feel the state can be most effective at addressing it? Is there a place you feel the state should be focusing its efforts first to have the most impact quickly?
That's a good question. I haven't thought of it in that sense because, you know, I've just thought about, you know, affordable housing across mm-hmm. the board, and everyone is experiencing not having that affordable housing. Someone told me that they live in Bear, mm-hmm. and they want to live in Middletown.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, Middletown is growing
right.
tremendously. And it's not, but it's not affordable to people. And then I went down to Georgetown, and I was talking to the mayor down in Georgetown, and he was telling me about the Pallet Village
yes.
that they constructed, and how that has brought 40 or so people off, and in his words, out of the woods. Mm-hmm. Into housing, and perhaps temporary, but nevertheless housing. It brought them out from outside. And then you go up to Wilmington, they have affordable issues. So I haven't really thought about, is there an area that we want to focus on first? But you know, what I focus on more so is that how do we just resolve the affordable housing issue? I am, you know, we talked earlier about the Behavioral Health Consortium.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I imagine that what I would like to do is have that same kind of project or
structure.
Not really a
yeah.
structure, not really a project, but a structure for Housing Health
mm-hmm.
Consortium, where we bring in builders and landlords, renters, bankers, mortgagers, we can come together and decide and figure out how do we resolve the housing, the affordable housing issue. And I think that we got to bring even those nonprofits in there so that we come together just like that Behavioral Health Consortium and figure out what is the structure that we need in order to resolve the housing, the affordable housing issue.
Let's move on to healthcare cost and access. That's also become very stubborn issues in the state. Delaware is one of the highest costs of care in the nation while struggling to attract and retain providers
yes.
and specialists. We see it play out in a lot of different areas. There's cost of coverage for state employees and retirees
yes.
To dealing with an aging population and
yes.
their needs.
Yes.
Lawmakers did do some work on the state retiree benefits this year, also created the Hospital Cost Review Board, which is, though, currently being sued by ChristianaCare
right.
Over its legality. What would you advocate prioritizing to address cost and access in healthcare here in Delaware?
The state employees, I think that when you, and it's sort of plain and simple for me, when you say this is the commit to, this mm-hmm. is the structure that we're going to, state structure, health structure that we're going to provide you, then you ought to be true to that. And I'm not clear yet on how the state can subsidize or change the health costs. That's something that I have to look into
mm-hmm.
more. But I do believe that the cost of health is tremendous, and just as it's not as affordable when you on top of the other things that we have to do, housing,
mm-hmm.
You know, we have to do education, before and after care, you know, all the things that we, transportation costs, all the things that we have to do, we got to figure out what we need to do with the health costs.
So we've talked about a number of issues that as you just said, kind of come with a cost. That it's all about money.
It's all about money,
And the outgoing governor, John Carney, has taken a more cautious, pragmatic approach toward spending. He's emphasized one-time spending, so-called budget smoothing, setting aside dollars as a hedge against future economic downturns. What approach would you advocate to balancing spending, some of the things that we talked about that, that need spending, but remaining fiscally responsible?
Good question. good question. So I have to think about that because I do believe that there are certain things we have to decide, that, as I said, that we have to just invest in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to have reserve for emergency. But I don't think we have to overdo reserve at the expense of some other things like education and health costs. I'm not sure about that mm-hmm. question. I don't have an exact answer for that. But I would say that we must invest in the things that affect people's lives.
And just be smart about the spending.
And be smart about the spending, yes. Let's be smart about the spending and invest in the things that's going to carry us, further into generationally, So that's my thought on that.
I do want to ask you a little bit of kind of a writ large question about where we stand as a democratic society, right? There seems to be a stronger distrust of government right now and calls for more transparency and accountability from our government and political figures.
Yes.
What role do you feel the Lieutenant Governor's office and you personally can play in giving Delawareans greater transparency and accountability?
So I think it's public meetings, it's, those sessions, legislative sessions where we are making policy, that they are open to the public and on several different formats. So I think that we, our legislators, people like the Lieutenant Governor, have to be out connecting to the community, talking to the community, more town halls where we are talking about the policies that we are making and that we are open with people so that they can, we are available, we are accessible so that they can ask the questions, so that they can understand what the government is doing. And part of that calls for, as I said, getting out there connecting to the community. That's something that I love doing. It's the reason that I am running for Lieutenant Governor, connecting people to resources. And that's the part of the Lieutenant Governor's position that we don't talk much about. We talk about the statutory requirement, the chair in the Senate, chair in the Board of Pardons, but we don't talk about that part of the Lieutenant Governor's position where that person is connecting people and communities and organizations to resources, being out there talking to the community, telling them what we're doing, what the government, and people will be less distrusting of the government if we're out there with them, educating them.
One of the things people have suggested in terms of transparency and accountability has been creating an Inspector General's office in Delaware.
Yeah.
Is that something you would support?
Yeah. Yeah, I would support that. I really would support that. And that would be an office that is that people can trust and they can believe that is transparent and that it is that office is looking at what we are doing as a government to ensure that we are doing the right things. And I'm not saying that the government is not doing the right things. I'm saying that people don't trust that we're doing the right things. but that's a matter of lack of education. And I think that if you let people know what you're doing, if you're talking to them constantly, consistently about in the town halls, in the webinars, if you're talking to them consistently, that they can know and they can see what you're doing and be trained, and you answering their questions. We're not running away from their questions, but answering them, I think that they could learn to trust the government.
That's Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor Debbie Harrington. Our full conversation with her is available at DelawarePublic.org. and stay with us. We continue our series of Races to Watch with a look at the Democratic primary for the 29th House District seat in Kent County. That's next, here on The Green, on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on this special edition of The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. As part of our 2024 election coverage, Delaware Public Media is highlighting a series of races to watch ahead of the September primary. Our series continues in Kent County, where an incumbent Democrat in the state House faces a primary challenge. For the first time since winning the 29th House District seat, State Representative Bill Bush must earn his spot on the November general election ballot. Bush and Monica Shockley Porter face off for that spot in the September 10th Democratic primary. And Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee has more on both candidates and where they stand.
The 29th House District has been blue since 2012 when Trey Pardee, now a state senator, won the seat and held it through 2018. Now, Bill Bush is seeking to hold it for a fourth term against political newcomer Monica Shockley Porter. Bush takes morning walks through different communities in District 29 and hosts meetups over coffee.
I truly enjoy what I do. Constituent service is my passion. I am in this position because I really love to help people. What I really love is in my communities, and I get the opportunity to help my constituents with all kinds of problems.
Shockley Porter says heading into her campaign, it was her constituents that built her priority list, which originally included voting rights, gun safety regulations, and abortion rights.
I don't want to just make these blanket general statements that are safe, right? But I really wanted to drill down on what the issues were within the community and what folks were sharing with me.
So her list shifted, and she now focuses on mental health, education, road safety, and workers' rights. Shockley Porter and Bush have some overlapping priorities. Bush also prioritizes education. He previously served on the Caesar Rodney School Board and the Board of Trustees for Delaware Technical Community College. Bush sponsored legislation during his first term boosting mental health services in elementary schools and sponsored another bill signed in August doing the same in Delaware high schools.
Especially after coming out of COVID, I think there's a greater need now than there has ever been for more mental health services within our schools.
Bush also sees a wider need for health care facilities to help address the state's growing senior population, including in Kent County.
I hope we can think about maybe more facilities up in that area. I think we also need more doctors so people don't have to wait for an appointment or things along those lines.
Shockley Porter's background is in education and mental health. She currently works for the Capital School District. She has firsthand experience working with families who need mental and behavioral health support and has experienced it in her own family. Shockley Porter aims to make sure wellness centers for students remain well-funded, but she says there's also a broader need for mental health care, particularly in areas like Kent County.
Especially in our more rural communities, there's a huge need for mental health services and mental health supports to be available. Again, that's a funding issue. So I definitely believe that there's a need to pour more resources into mental health.
The economy is also a key part of Shockley Porter and Bush's campaign platforms. Bush says he wants to make sure Delaware and specifically Kent County are places businesses want to be with the goal of creating jobs with higher wages.
We, on our end, need to make sure it's a great place for businesses to set up, that we're supportive, that, you know, we can do different things in terms of helping to, you know, hopefully keep down different insurance rates and other rates so that they can be successful.
Bush wants to see more manufacturing companies settle in Kent County and notes some companies like Delmarva Corrugated Packaging are already bringing new jobs to Delaware. Bush was the primary sponsor of a bill that includes a loan program for micro businesses, which might otherwise lack the resources to start up or keep doors open. Shockley Porter emphasizes workers' rights, like ensuring employees have sick time and safety leave when discussing the economy.
Workers are essential. We can't operate or maintain anything without our staff members or workers. I am very focused on just the average working family. I really want to drill down on what they need and not necessarily what companies may need or corporations may need.
Bush says he also supports workers, noting he co-sponsored a bill earlier this year that would require Delaware employers provide a minimum of 1 hour of earned sick time and safety leave for every 30 hours worked. That bill stalled in committee. There are a variety of other issues each candidate says figure predominantly in their agendas. Shockley Porter would like to see the General Assembly continue to pursue strong gun safety legislation.
I definitely believe that gun violence is a health crisis and definitely stand for gun safety regulations. I have experienced losing loved ones to gun violence, so that's something that I believe needs to continue to be addressed here in Delaware and across our nation.
Bush says Delaware state government needs to address racial inequities, including those present in criminal justice and health care.
Systemic racism is something I want to ensure that we eliminate within our criminal justice system as well as within all of our government itself. There's probably some things I'm going to continue to move forward with and trying to eliminate some things where I see systemic racism.
As they make their final pitch to voters, Bush says that residents of the 29th District know him and what he can do.
What I can tell you, I am a hard worker, and I believe in working with my constituents, helping my constituents, and I think what I do in our communities is really good, and I think I am the best person for the job.
Shockley Porter wants voters to know she's deeply rooted in the district and in Delaware.
My family has been in Delaware, oh my goodness, we can trace our roots back to the 1700s, which is pretty just amazing to be able to trace our roots here in Delaware back to the 1700s. I'm an African-American woman, so we can trace our roots to a plantation actually in Sussex County. And Delaware is just near and dear to my heart.
The winner of this race faces Republican Anthony Ehipsiaco Jr. in the November general election in a district where Democrats hold a nearly 2-to-1 registration advantage, but independents make up nearly a third of voters. Abigail Lee, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Abigail, for bringing us a look at that race to watch in Kent County. And that's all we have time for on this special edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this special edition of the show possible, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee. Our Candidate Conversations producers, Ethan Grandin, Jeet Hanslin, and Robert Stice. And Delaware Public Media's senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us on this special edition of The Green, and we'll see you again Friday on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.